Right. Hello once again, and welcome. Sorry for the slightly late start. Apparently there's a strike with petrol. Anyway, apologies for that. Anyways, once again, it's great to see so many people here for the third edition, the third talk in the third edition of Human Entities. We're CADA. I'm Jared Hawkey. This is Sophia Oliveira. And as organisers of this event, we must thank the DG Arts, whose financial support has made this event possible. CADA would also like to thank our partner, the Lisbon Architecture Triennale, for hosting and promoting the event. And we're also especially grateful to our supporters, the Lisbon City Council, Professor Nunu Correia at Nova Links, Nova University, Lisbon, and Assistant Professor Alessandra Pio at the Department of Architecture and Urbanism at ISCTE, or University Institute of Lisbon. Thank you all.
So, why are we here? Oh, it's too loud. Is it too loud? That was it? Close? Okay. This is like a weapon. She's a biometric weapon because she's recording my voice. So why are we here today? Today we are here to discuss the political risks associated with AI when it's used with biometrics. This includes any system capable of identifying individuals via face recognition, voice, iris scan, DNA, fingerprints, body movements, and other so-called behavioral data. Recently, the potential mass deployment of this technology has been highlighted as companies like Amazon develop facial recognition tools, which are then sold to governments and police forces. The mass use of these systems in public space increases the risk of a panopticon, the dystopia of an all-seeing state. We see how China is using its biometric system with AI to control its population. But it is and will be gradually more and more used as well in our liberal democracies. So the need to assess and debate if and how do we as a society want this class of technology in our everyday lives is urgent. So it's a great honor to have Stephanie Hare, a specialist in this area, with us today. As Stephanie has said, when the world's most powerful and profitable technology companies ask governments to regulate their activities, you know there is a problem. When companies like Microsoft ask for regulation on facial recognition, saying it's too risky to leave the tech industry alone, that should give us a sign of the urgent need for increased public involvement. So, yesterday, the reason why Stephanie is here was made all the more real when a Facebook ad promoting today's talk was blocked by Facebook with the explanation from them that its content was related to politics and issues of national importance. Subsequently, we made a test to trick Facebook, and we made an ad of a post where we exposed this, and it's still running. So who is Stephanie Hare? Stephanie Hare is an independent researcher and broadcaster focused on technology, politics, and history. She shares her opinions regularly on BBC World Service TV and radio and has published on Harvard Business Reviews, The Financial Times, CNN, The Guardian, amongst others. She has held the Alistair Horn Visiting Fellowship at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, has a PhD and MSc from the London School of Economics and a BA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you very much, Sophia, for that introduction, and to Sophia and Jared and CADA for hosting me and all of you and all of our sponsors here. I really appreciate it. And it's such a pleasure to escape Brexit Britain to come to beautiful Lisbon to talk about a tech nightmare. So there is one Brexit joke, so just get ready. I couldn't resist. Some really interesting things happened in the run-up to this talk. So we discussed the fact that Facebook didn't want to post the ad. They didn't officially ban it. They blocked it, which amounts to the same thing, on the grounds that biometrics is a topic that relates to politics and issues of national importance. On the one hand, I was deeply pissed off by this, because Facebook likes to say that it is not a publisher, it's a platform, and therefore it's not responsible for what content gets put on the site. And we all know that there's some pretty dodgy, sketchy things that go on Facebook. So the fact that they would censor an academic who is trying to bring to the public a year's worth of my research so that we can have a stronger democracy underscores some of the problems with Facebook's AI model and Facebook's business model. And I think that's just worth us all sort of taking a note and going. But I'm also intrigued because this topic that we're talking about today is alive. I trained as an historian, and I'm used to studying things that are something you can put under the microscope, and it's quiet. And my work on technology over the past year has been some of the most demanding that I've ever done, and I covered the Euro crisis for 5 years, so that was fairly stressful. This is even harder because it's like trying to chase a moving target. And with biometrics, and particularly with the face, people in the West are starting to wake up to the dangers and the possibilities of things like facial recognition technology. So I'm going to take you through some of the things that I've found. I'm also going to situate that in a broader context of biometrics. And biometrics is just simply your data about your body. So it's a very happy dog sharing and being part of this. So we have a very clear outline. A professor is in town. This used to be a school for children. So I feel like I'm going to take my jacket off if you don't mind. We'll get started with the lecture. And we'll take lots of questions, I hope, at the end in comments. And you can tell me where I'm getting it wrong, which is what I love most from the audience, how to do it better. So biometrics. Data about your body and your behavior. A really easy way to understand this is that your DNA and your fingerprints are most likely to be the two types of biometrics that are protected in law. Okay? But everything else is fair game. So that's a problem. But number two is that DNA and fingerprints are only protected when it comes to being used by the police. Not by other branches of government, and not by private companies. So I want you to think about that for a moment. You have greater rights when the police have your DNA, when you are a suspect of a crime, than if you take a little cheek swab, put it in an envelope, and send it off to Ancestry.com to find out if your family are related to the Vikings, which is fun. Right? It's fun to find out if you're related to the Vikings, but you've just given over not just your DNA, but the DNA of everyone in your family. Okay? And did you get their consent? Probably not. And unfortunately, you've just exposed the people that you're most closest to, and then it goes out. So it's your parents, it's your children, it's your siblings. And then grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins, etc. So simply by allowing that area not to be regulated, we've created an industry where most people in the United States, because the United States is a very enthusiastic adopter of this kind of DNA testing, Americans love to find out where they're from, you don't need to have a DNA sample from someone anymore now. You can figure it out. So many millions of Americans have given their DNA samples to these companies that the FBI is now using this as part of their investigations. And what's really interesting is they are not bound by the same laws as they would be if they were using a police DNA database. So the lawyers have some work to do, and so does our government. Now, I've put this in here. I think it's really important for us to understand that the face, the emotions, and the voice are probably, in my opinion, the creepiest, as in like, of biometrics, because you can take them easily without you even knowing. You could be in an area, there could be cameras all over this building reading every single one of our faces and recording it and comparing it to a database, and we might not know. And that could be happening on streets, that could be happening in parks, places where you would kind of assume that you have anonymity, right? It could be happening in shops. And they can do all sorts of very interesting things with that data. None of this is regulated. It's happening. They are rolling it out without protections. And I just want to say, I'm not going to spend a lot of time in this talk on voice. That's something I'm going to be developing for later work. But in a 30-second sample of your voice, you can identify all sorts of physical data about a person. You can even reconstruct their face up to 60 to 70% from 30 seconds of a voice sample over a phone, over a wiretap, if you just catch them in public. And you can't, the reason I think that face and voice are so creepy and require special protection in law is that you can't not show your face, right? This isn't one of those things where capitalists like to say, you have a choice. You don't have to use Facebook. It's true, I don't. I do need to show my face, and I need to be able to speak. And I would like to be able to speak without my voice being recorded and analyzed to find out the likelihood of whether or not I have Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, cardiovascular disease, which in the United States, that information could be used to deny me healthcare coverage, but I would never know why. You can know that somebody has those diseases before the person does, before their doctor does. That's how intimate your voice data is. And there's a scholar whose work I have been studying, who I'd like to honor and to cite. Her name is Rita Singh. She's at Carnegie Mellon University in the United States. She's got a book coming out later this year. She teaches forensics and machine learning and AI. She is doing groundbreaking work on this kind of software to analyze the voice. So everything that we're seeing now about the face, you can expect to see people starting to wake up about the voice. So I'm telling you stuff that even for me is cutting edge. I only learned this a few weeks ago and it's blown my mind. I want us to compare and contrast between these slides. This slide is just about your body, okay? No tech needs to be involved, I just need to scan you. But in the next slide, I'm going to show you a concept called the extended self, which basically becomes almost as good as your body. So if you have a smartphone, as I do now, setting an alarm going off, if you have a smartphone, that's tracking you everywhere you go. Even if you turn all of the location history off, particularly if you've got Google on your phone, it's tracking you. Your apps are tracking you. If you take photos, those photos are stamped with a time and location stamp. Okay? So that's, we are all basically wearing a monitoring device if we have our phones. And this is why in the United States, the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, has ruled that you can't just take someone's smartphone without a warrant, because it's basically on their body all the time. So we've crossed a line, right? Humans, the human-machine merge has become one. You know, it's part of me, and you need a warrant to access it now. Your social media and online profiles, yes, we all know that we need to be careful about what we post, right? Putting pictures of your kids now, you might really want to think about that. And even putting pictures of you now, you might want to think about that. But there's a lot more that you can find out about somebody by analyzing their social media and online activity, depending on who you are. If you're the secret services of your country or law enforcement, you're going to have a very good idea of what's going on in someone's life. But so could people who are trying to impersonate you for fraud, right? For financial fraud, identity theft, stalkers, abusers in relationships, right? So you want to be just mindful of what you're doing. The microchip phenomenon, that's just something where they take a little chip that's about the size of a grain of rice. And believe it or not, people are actually volunteering to have this put in their hand in this area. They do it at work so that they don't need to have a pass to get in the building. Yes, I know. And you don't need to have a key to open a door. And you can store information on it. And again, you can see why some of this is quite handy. It is annoying to have a pass, right? It's annoying to have to remember all of the passwords that we all have to remember nowadays. I can't remember half of mine. And you could put information if somebody had a health condition, right? So that the emergency services, if somebody collapses at work, could see, they've got one of those chips, and boom, understand their entire medical history if they need a certain kind of medication or if they're allergic to a certain medication. So we start to see that technology becomes very nuanced very quickly. Every positive seems to have a negative, and vice versa. And this requires us to think and make decisions as a society about where we want the law to be to protect us. Those wearable fitness devices like Fitbit and Garmin that you put on your wrist and then you can go jogging and run a faster marathon, unfortunately, also are tracking your location. So that's why, for instance, in the United States military, those soldiers aren't allowed to wear those anymore because they were giving away their locations around military bases in Afghanistan, right? The cybersecurity around all of these devices is terrible. So you need to think very carefully. I don't want to make you paranoid. I just want to like help us all go, oh God, what am I doing? And we've all done it. We've all overshared, right? But just, we need to be reading these things that are happening in the news and going, well, why are military people not allowed to wear that anymore? If it's so dangerous for them, why is it fine for my child or for me? And I've put here your home. As we start moving into things like smart homes, right? Connected homes, connected devices in our homes will give out all sorts of data about what is normal about you at home versus what is normal about me. You could track somebody's hours of when they're in the house. How many people are in the house? How much energy are they using, right? And you start to get data. You combine that with the data about them that you get from their car. A lot of cars are going to start having cameras, so you will be filmed as you are driving. And the camera will be able to read your emotions to determine if you are tired, if you've had too much to drink. If you are being emotional, perhaps you are arguing with your boyfriend or girlfriend or child, that could have functionality that means if the car thinks that you're too tired or too drunk, it could intervene. It could even stop working. It could literally pull you over, right? So who's in charge, humans or machines? All of that is going to have data. And think about it, your car is going to be, for a lot of people, it's unlike your phone, right? If you're driving for work, it shows all of your patterns. You go to the marital counselor because your marriage has problems. You're an alcoholic and you're going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Got to drive there. That's tracked. Who has all of the data? Who has access to that data, right? So your private life is being recorded by all of these things. Schools are increasingly online. They are putting cameras in schools to monitor children to see if they are paying attention. Are they learning? This is optional. We have a choice to decide as grown-ups if we're comfortable with that or if we think that's just weird, right? If we don't want our kids being analyzed and tracked in that way. We need to decide. And we need to tell our governments what we want. At the workplace, I just did a broadcast on the BBC World Service last week that I'll happily send the link to because it's available globally, on all of the different things that employers are doing to monitor you at work. So that pass that you have to get in and out of the building might be not just tracking what time you arrive at work and leave work, it's going to track you all around the building, all day. It will track you when you go to the toilet. It will track how long you spend in the toilet. It will track that I like to talk to you quite a lot, but not you so much. And maybe I'm having an affair with you. How weird, because your location data shows that you got in my car and we went home together. Like, does your employer need to know that? If you're wearing a Fitbit that your employer gave you, in the United States they love to do this as part of the wellness thing, right? We want healthy, happy workers. Here, have a Fitbit. Fitbits can reveal when a woman is pregnant before she knows. Pregnancy discrimination is alive and well as a problem. Women get pushed out of jobs, denied promotion. We already know women don't get paid the same as men for doing the same work, even when they're equally qualified, and sometimes even when they're better qualified. A really great way for a woman to lose her job, to lose a promotion, or to be discriminated against is for her boss to find out she's pregnant. That little device that she thinks she's wearing to help her be fit and healthy could give that information away. So we want to be aware of that. How is that data being used? Smart cities. Our cities are going to be becoming very smart indeed. There's a new telecommunications infrastructure that is starting to be rolled out. It's called 5G. It's super fast. It's up to 100 times faster than what we have now. And that is going to take all of the sensors that are around our cities and turn them on. Right now, we don't have fast enough speed for them to be very useful, but we will within a few years' time, which means your city is going to be tracking all sorts of things about you, potentially in aggregate, so they could anonymize it, right? And it's just useful to know air pollution levels, right? I'm living in London at the moment where the air pollution is illegal. It's so bad, and it's making children sick. It's making grown-ups like me sick who have asthma. I'm quite happy for London to monitor air pollution, right? I'm not happy for London to monitor where I'm going in the city during the day. I don't think that's any of London's business, right? There's a balance to be struck, and we just want to talk about that, and we want to get it put into law because none of it is. And finally, I put at the end country, and I did a little UK. We're so used to, for instance, when we go to an airport, when I came here today, my face was scanned because I have a biometric passport. I got a biometric passport years ago when I didn't think about risks about any of this stuff. I thought it was great because it meant I did not have to stand in line at the airport. It would save me time. I love technology. I work in technology. I thought a biometric passport's great, and it is. In airports, we're used to it. It's almost like the rules in an airport are different than in our normal lives because none of us want to have terrorism, right? None of us want to have the types of crime that you could have there, which would be really terrible. But in a way, it's softened us a bit to being like, oh yeah, in certain circumstances, I'm totally happy for someone to scan my face. There's like no other area of my life where I would be happy with that. But in an airport, I'm like, go ahead. Yes, that's my passport, right? But I have no idea what the country of Portugal does with my data in the airport. I don't know what company has built the equipment that they're using. Is it a Chinese company? Is it an American company? Do they store that data? In the United States, they store the biometric data of every foreigner who enters my country for 75 years. 75 years. You go to the United States, we've got you. We've got your fingerprints, we've got your face. It's interesting, right? That only happened after 9/11. That's a response to terrorism. Every single international airport in the United States is going to be using automatic facial recognition technology by 2020. That's part of an executive order that was signed by President Donald Trump. 17 of those airports already have it. There's 3 more to go. There will not be a single airport in the United States that you could travel to as a foreigner that will not be taking your data. Now, maybe you're fine with that. Maybe you trust the United States. I don't want to judge. I know personally that there are countries that I don't want having my data. I'm American. They actually aren't supposed to have mine, or any Americans. But Donald Trump signed an executive order in 2017 saying that they could take Americans' data as well. And he did that without going through the United States Congress, which is illegal. So we have a power problem on our hands in the United States right now, which is that 330 million American citizens can now have their facial data taken by the United States government and put into a digital database. And Congress, the people who make our laws, said nothing. That's happening in a liberal democracy. I'm not going to scare you with this slide. This is just to let you know that this slide exists and that you are going to be able to have it because I have sent the deck to Sophia. I'm making it publicly available so that if anyone wants to read it later, they can. Some people like to look at detail. I'm more of a picture person. And I'm going really fast in the wrong way. So I'm just letting you know it's there. I've taken all of the things that were at the bottom of the screen, like home, car, school, etc., and I've just put them down the left-hand side and given a really detailed breakdown, all right? I loved it when my professors did stuff like this for me, so I want to do it for you. If you are here about biometrics, I'm assuming you're interested and want to know. That is some of my hardest thinking to date on this, where I have tried to work through myself. What do each one of these categories, what do they give in terms of data? Like, do I need to be worried or not, right? Like, this is how I was arguing with myself. You'll notice that most of them provide geolocation in real time. Very useful for both the private sector and the state. And I've highlighted in red the sort of key areas. And you'll notice it's face, fertility, heart rate, sleep patterns, body language, fingerprints. Right, so I haven't done so much on voice yet because voice is so cutting edge. I didn't know about it when I started working on this even a few weeks ago. So I'll have to update. But so far, I think this is a decent crack on. So I'm going to move on to the why should you care, because there's always a group in every audience that I've ever spoken to who's like, so what? I'm fine with this. I want to get through the airport faster, which I'm like, don't we all? So I have made this slide for you if you are that person. Biometrics sounds great, right? It solves a lot of problems, so it's important for us to understand that and really like reckon with it. It's more convenient. No need for a wallet if you can pay with your face. This is already happening in China. It is also happening in certain stores in the United States who are, you know, quick. Americans love convenience. We are very, very lazy. So we want stuff to be easy. Surveillance as a service. I love that. You're worried about your elderly relative, but you're not there. What can you do? You can have them monitored. And then you get an update on your phone as to how your elderly parent is doing. You can survey your kids in this way, right? So a lot of people are doing this, and they're not realizing that the devices that they're giving to monitor their kids are really hackable, very easy to be hacked. So in trying to solve a problem that you as a parent, you care about your kid, you want to keep them safe, this device sounds like it will solve that problem, you've actually just exposed them to a huge risk. The kind of people who are hacking children's monitoring devices are not good people, right? So like, this is one of those, the cure is worse than the disease. We need to think it through. It's more cyber secure. If I can, you know, have my passwords hacked all the time, but if I can use, and I use this on my iPhone, I use my thumbprint. It's great. Some people will use their face. It's not your actual thumbprint. That's an important thing to understand on an Apple iPhone or your actual face. What they do is they take it, they then create what's called a hash. That's a mathematical representation, like in code. The original is then deleted. The code is what's matched on the phone. And also, important difference is that only I am transacting with that. Even that mathematical code does not go and sit on Apple's servers. They don't keep it. That's why in the United States there was a very important court case just a couple of years ago, the San Bernardino case after a terrorism attack in California, where they wanted to get access to someone's phone. And it's this big thing, and Apple was like, we can't, even if we wanted to, we can't. Ah, we coded it deliberately so that we can't, because we knew you would ask. And that is a deliberate choice on Apple's part. That's a design choice. Because they could have just as easily made it, as Google does, sure, give us a warrant. You know, we're not just going to hand it over to you, but give us a warrant, we'll hand you the data. So companies are making different decisions. Engineers are making different decisions, right? We as customers make a different decision. I've already covered the how biometrics can get you through the airport faster and on your way. Save money, that's not for you, the customer, unfortunately, that's for businesses, right? Because if you can use pay with your face, you don't need to have staff in stores to do the transaction. People can just stand up, scan, go, right? So that's lower cost for them. And then obviously the big one is fighting crime, and that's the one that you're gonna hear a lot of. It's either gonna be, it's saving money, it's more convenient, or it's safer, we don't want the terrorists to win. And that's a really difficult one to contend with, because I think no one normal wants the criminals or terrorists to win. The problem is, again, is the cure worse than the disease? That's what we need to be rigorous about in our thinking. So it is probably true that once we get a completely accurate database of everyone on the planet, that criminals and terrorists are going to find it harder to do their jobs. Right? We can imagine that world. And for some of us, that sounds great, like we're fine with that trade-off. You could monitor people who you think are likely to commit a crime, right? And that's happening. That's happening by police forces all over the world. The United States and the UK love this. It's called predictive policing. The problem is, it's not great technology, right? Like artificial intelligence is not where we necessarily think it is. A lot of people who love AI will hype it up that it's solving everything. But loads of research has shown time and time again that predictive policing just ends up policing people who already are part of an over-policed group. Right? So certain people who live in certain neighborhoods, if you're poorer, if you're an immigrant, if you're a person of color, you're going to keep getting triggered over and over again. So maybe if you are a wealthy white person living in the rich part of Chicago, you're like, predictive policing doesn't bother me, that's fine. You're not the one getting targeted. So it doesn't affect you, right? It doesn't affect the city of Chicago equally to have predictive policing. Who's it affecting? It's affecting people who live on the south side of Chicago, which is predominantly African American. It's much poorer. It does have higher drugs. It does have higher guns. Although it doesn't necessarily have higher drugs, because of course drugs are being consumed in the rich area as well, right? It's just not getting picked up by those algorithms. This matters. This matters if we care about equality in our society. And then the big one, and this is a tricky one to get your head around. So in London right now, we have a knife crime epidemic. Right? Like loads of people are getting stabbed. It's predominantly young people, teenagers, and people in their 20s. And you can see from the police perspective, and we want to help the police, right? We want the police to be able to do their job well and to have good relations with the community. The police are like, we are under so much pressure, and they are. The politicians and society and the media are really pressuring them to crack down on knife crime. Why haven't the police solved knife crime? So you get into the police perspective and you think, all right, let's pretend we have, you know, 100,000 police officers. We could put them anywhere in London. What do? Do we go for the politically correct answer and put police in every single neighborhood so that they are all policed equally? Or do we start to put them in areas that we know historically the data shows have a higher rate of knife crime incidents? Maybe more people are phoning in. More hospitals are phoning in going, we've just had 5 kids delivered today, stabbed to death in this one neighborhood. Does it make sense to then have a bunch of police over in that area if they need to be here, right? So you can see the police are trying to do the best they can with the resources they have, and they're trying to use data and technology to do the best job that they can to keep everyone safe. This makes sense. We want them to be able to do that. So how do we make sure that they do it in a way that is ethical, right? That's responsible and that is equal. And a lot of people, as you go through the slide, will say, do you know what? I have nothing to hide, so I have nothing to fear. This is not a problem for me. Like, hand the biometrics over. It's worth it for me to feel safe. I want the convenience, and I want to save money if I can. I have written that slide for you. It's wrong. It's wrong for two reasons. In a liberal democracy, we do not have to prove that we have nothing to hide. Okay? I think it's really worth repeating that because I keep hearing this argument and I have yet to see someone really skewer it. So I'm going to volunteer to be the person who stands up today and attempts to skewer that argument because I've really had it. We don't have to prove we have nothing to hide. We are innocent until proven guilty in a liberal democracy. We have centuries-old legal and social traditions that support that statement. In the United States, it's done under the U.S. Constitution. European countries will have their own laws. We have our different laws here in the EU. You don't have to prove that you have nothing to hide. The law has to prove that there's a reason to suspect you. They have to give evidence before a judge to get a warrant to search your home. They can't just come in, right? Like, a bunch of cops can't just show up at your door and come in your house. That's in law. They can't just walk into your business and take out your computers and your phone and be like, see you later. You as a citizen have rights. They would be in trouble. The media would go to town on them. They would have a real problem in court, so they don't do it, right? That is life in liberal democracy. We have these set in stone. So our biometrics are our most personal, revealing, intimate, powerful data about us. More powerful than anything that's even on my computers and phones, and those are pretty powerful, right? They're more powerful than the data from our homes, our workplaces, our vehicles, even our offices, and they are recording tons of data on us. All of those things are protected in law. But our biometrics are not, with the exception of DNA and fingerprints for the police only. I personally think that if biometrics and biometrics technologies had existed several centuries ago, the people who crafted our laws would have protected them. But they couldn't have. It wasn't possible. They didn't even know what DNA was when the US Constitution was written. Okay? We have to update our laws to reflect it because we're not even being logical from a point of law. And I actually think that biometrics deserve far more protections than our home and our business. Another scary slide, don't worry. This is for bedtime reading later, and there's two of them. The difference is that this is me trying to be fair. Biometrics solve a lot of problems. They also create a lot of problems. I am not going to talk you through all of those today. We'd be here all night. But I just want to outline this for you and let you know that it's here. You can read it later. I have tried to really crunch this for you. I put convenience in red and security in blue. So that's here, because those are the ones that I hear most. I would love to hear from you as you think through this yourselves. If you think this is terrible thinking and, you know, you can do a better job, do it. Send it to me. I'll probably quote you in my next work, right? And I've tried to give concrete examples. So, you know, here's all the things that you can do with biometrics. Here's some practical examples. And here's why it's quite useful. Here's the problem it solves, right? But then I flip it. I kept the absolute categories the same. Right, for the first and second column, all I did was go, yeah, but here's all the problems that biometrics usage in that situation creates. That's the whole point. It's like, it's great, but it's terrible. It's really, really convenient. It's a total human rights violation. Yeah, but it doesn't affect me. Yeah, but it affects my neighbors. Oh, awkward, right? This is our generation's task. We have to do this homework because there's a whole crew of children counting on us to figure this out. I'm sure many of you have kids in this room. I've got nephews and two very little goddaughters who are totally cute. And when I spend time with them, I am struck time and time again on how they look up at me, hold my hand, ask me questions about the world, and they are counting on me to keep them safe. They are counting on me to explain to them, how does this work? What does this mean? Why is this happening? You know, if you spend time around little kids, it's questions, questions, questions. Already, we are seeing the generation of children born after 1995, when the internet first started to become viable, particularly in the 2000s. Those kids are coming of age now. They're starting to go online, and a lot of them are finding out to their horror that their entire lives have been online. Right? Sometimes from the time a woman gets pregnant and puts her pregnancy scan on Instagram or Facebook, I'm pregnant, hooray! That baby did not have consent. Right? The cute two-year-old did not give consent. Do children have rights or not? And it sounds really pedantic, like, that's outrageous, those are my children. If I want to put a naked picture of them on the Facebook, I will. Don't tell me what to do. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm telling you that we need to think about what we want to do. Because those kids had a right to a private life. And all of us had that private life as children. Because these technologies didn't exist before, so yes, our parents took pictures of us, but they couldn't share it. It couldn't go viral. It couldn't be videos of us on YouTube. It couldn't have 2 million hits on Instagram. I have also noted here on the left something called captive audiences, which is a concept to think about. I've mentioned how in airports, it's kind of like they have a different rule, right? There's different laws in an airport. I spend a lot of time in airports, and there really is a different vibe. Schools are kind of the same thing, right? There's rules in school, and we treat children differently than we do adults. And there's a really important reason I'm signaling schools. It's coming up. This is foreshadowing for later in the talk. In the United Kingdom, where I live, they have been taking children's biometrics since 1999, and they were doing it without the consent of the child or the parents. It's 2019 now. Some of those kids have had their biometrics taken their entire lives. Where is that data stored? Who in government approved that? What company has that data? What's their track record on cybersecurity and data breaches? Was your child affected? Right? Like, the workplace is a great example of where you're kind of a captive audience, right? Like, you can choose to not work at a place that is surveying you, absolutely. But what are you going to do when all workplaces are surveying you because no one bothered to create laws to set some rules on this? And remember, that is always, it's a power flow. The executives and HR and security get to know about you through workplace surveillance. You will not get to know the information about the people in charge in your company, right? This is not two-way traffic. This is not equal traffic. I'm not like, cool, you know what? You can know my heart rate. You can know my movements and where I go jogging, absolutely, and I'm going to get to know yours. No, I do not get to know my boss's data. HR does not get to know that. Prisons are another place where we are seeing biometric data being tested, taken and used, because prisoners are a captive audience. Who cares about prisoners? Right? It's a terrible question. But like, are most people gonna get off their butts and go and lobby for the rights of prisoners? There's an exceptional few, right? People who are really committed to prison reform, to human rights, they will do it. But will the average person on the street take a stand for the rights of prisoners? It's really easy to test on them. And refugees, who get really demonized at the moment, right? We have an immigration crisis. The United Nations has been using facial recognition technology, iris scans, and fingerprints on refugees. These are some of the most vulnerable people in the world. And it sounds great, right? If you can verify who that person is, they've maybe lost all of their identity papers fleeing whatever terrible circumstance they've come from. They have no ID. This solves a real problem. It also means once I can identify you as you, Mr. Refugee Number One, and I decide you get an allowance of $100 a month in the camp for food and supplies, every day when you want to come to me and get some money, I scan your iris, check it's you, boom, you can have your cash. This means that you always get the cash that you are owed, and I know that we don't have a fraud problem anymore. We don't have corruption problem anymore in terms of money because we can track the money, right? So it solves a real problem. You can see why the United Nations wants to use it and why a company called Accenture that I used to work for built that system for them. Do you know how many refugees there are in the world? 30 million? Do you think those people have a right to say, I don't want you taking my body data, actually. I can say that, right? I can say to my employer, I can say in my society, pretty much to anyone other than a cop or the airport people, I'm sorry, I'm not comfortable with that. I regularly tell people, I'm not comfortable with that. I don't want you to have my please don't take my photo, or I don't want you to have my email address if I go shopping, and they're like, would you like us to email you the receipt? I'm like, no, no, I'm fine, I'm good. Do you think a refugee has the right to say, I'm sorry, I'm actually really uncomfortable with you taking, they don't even know half the time what's being done. Why would they? Most of us don't know. We have access to far more information about it. Who is going to lobby on behalf of refugees having the option to say, do you know what, you can either opt into this technology or you can opt out. Equal service, either way, you will not be penalized if you decide you don't want to do it. No, take their data. And once it's taken, it's done. It's over. You've got it. So that captive audience concept to me is very important, because those are the people who are least able to fight for their rights. So, moving on to the cheerful part of the talk. Weirdly, and I say this as an American, I really cannot emphasize this point enough, American companies hate regulation. The word regulation is a dirty word in the United States. So if you have some of the most powerful technology companies in the world asking for the government to regulate facial recognition technology, pay attention. Microsoft today, it's in the New York Times, it went global in terms of the media, Microsoft has said it will not sell facial recognition technology to law enforcement in the state of California. It would not name which police force asked for it. Microsoft is taking a really interesting position. They're worried that that technology will lead to human rights violations. So they're building it, but they're not selling it yet. They want the government to craft regulation, because regulation creates rules, right? It creates a playing field, and then we can know. You can use it in this context, but not that. These are the penalties if you break the rules. It's very clear. Right now, nothing is clear about facial recognition technology, except, of course, the fact that it doesn't work. That's very clear. Researchers have demonstrated time and time again that facial recognition technology works best on white men, the very people who build it, strangely. It's a coincidence, that. It works worst on women of color, up to 33% worse. That doesn't sound like a big deal, but if it means you're being stopped by the cops constantly for reasons that are totally bullshit, right? That's a problem. That's how you're going to piss off an entire community of people who are just trying to live their lives, because you're like, oh, sorry, my tech's a bit buggy. I bought Amazon's recognition, facial recognition technology, which misidentified members of the United States Congress, strangely only the ones who were Latino and African American. Awkward. Amazon is refusing to not sell this technology. Its own shareholders demanded the right to vote to stop it from being sold. The board of the company has said that vote will go ahead. The United States Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, has also said that vote will happen. It will happen on May 22nd. It is a non-binding vote. The shareholders could say, we don't want to sell it. We need more research. We need to stop it. And Amazon could still keep selling technology that researchers have shown discriminates. To a police community in the United States that I think we can all say, even those of us who are very pro-law enforcement, has a problem with race and police violence. Technology that doesn't work, that can't be trusted, is going to make some of the problems between the police and some of the communities that they have the most sensitive relations with even more difficult. So it can actually end up hurting the police to use this technology, right? They're just trying to do their jobs, but if Amazon gives them bad tech, it's going to make it worse than if they just didn't use it at all. So Microsoft wants to stop it. I really like that President Brad Smith, he's come out quite strong on this. I mean, he's fully aware. He's like, wow, okay, this technology, a government could follow anyone, anywhere, or for that matter, everyone, everywhere. It could do this at any time, or even all the time. It could unleash mass surveillance on an unprecedented scale. Right? You're like, then why are you building it? Stop! Just stop! But he's like, oh, but I could help people in the airport. It's a lot of airports, that's a lot of money, right? But like, come on, Brad, you see it. And then the CEO of Microsoft, Satya Nadella, he's like, oh, this is it's just such a terrible business. I love this quote from him. The facial recognition technology business is just terrible. You know, it's like farmers are like, oh, farming is terrible this year. There's no rain. It's a race to the bottom. Whoever wins a deal can do anything, and that's not gonna do well for us as an industry or for us as a society. It would be better to have some rules so that we can protect what actually matters the most. So Microsoft is pushing hard for regulation. Amazon's like, yeah, it would be helpful. They're taking kind of a lukewarm approach. Google, who releases everything, right? Google loves to test stuff on us. Google's like, this stuff is so scary. It so doesn't work yet. We're not even going to try it out on you. Like, I'm sure they're doing all the stuff that they're doing back in their offices, but they're like, we're not selling it. We're out. Price of poker is too high on that one. And then there's IBM, which I would like to signal out for special attention tonight. IBM has a problem with ethics. IBM has been taking photographs of people from a website called Flickr without their knowledge or their consent and using it to train their machine learning. It is almost impossible to get the photos removed. There's no easy way of finding out if your photos were taken or not. So Olivia Solon of NBC News, you will note that part of the reason I know all of these things is that there's incredible journalists doing amazing journalism, and Olivia Solon of NBC is one of them. She and her colleagues broke that story, and they built a tool so that you can find out if you are one of the people whose photos was taken by IBM. IBM didn't do that. They didn't make it easy. It took a journalist to do it. IBM has a history of building surveillance technology, going back to the Second World War, but I'm not going to go that far back. We don't have all night. But I would like it acknowledged, footnoted, and we can discuss it later. It sold technology to the New York City Police Department that allowed it to search the CCTV feeds of all the cameras that are watching everyone, so that you can look for people with particular skin tones or hair color. That's maybe fine. If you've got a terror situation, and New York has had, God knows, a lot, right, and crime, and you need to be able to find a suspect quickly, it is helpful, right? Like, you don't want the police to say, who are you looking for? Describe the person with the gun running down Fifth Avenue and be like, ooh, I don't want, you know, it's to be politically correct. It's a person. Tell me what they look like. Oh, I don't want to name anything, right? You want to be able to say, 6'5", man, blonde hair, blue eyes, was wearing a red t-shirt. What ethnicity is that person? The police are going to ask that. If you remember it, they're going to ask it. Is that being racist or not? Right? In a law enforcement context, maybe you need to know it. In a counterterrorism context, maybe you need to know it. That's a decision that we're going to have to make. They've also released an intelligent video analytics product that uses the body camera surveillance that the cops are all wearing now to detect people by ethnicity tags. Because obviously America is a very racially charged society, right? So they literally are encoding culture into tech. So ethnic values are being coded for. Another country might not. These are decisions. My job tonight isn't to tell you if these are right or wrong. My job is just to emphasize that these are decisions. I would also like to highlight, though, that IBM has been involved in building the video surveillance and predictive police capabilities that we just discussed about how that can be quite tricky in a country called the Philippines, which I don't know if you follow, but the Philippines is currently run by a regime that carries out extrajudicial killings. These are state-sanctioned murders. No court of law, no evidence, just boom. So you can imagine how handy this kind of surveillance technology would be. Now, I'm sure IBM would like me to stress that they're not building the facial recognition technology component. They stopped, I think, in 2016. It started in 2012 and stopped in 2016. Now the Philippines is not looking to IBM to build its next generation of facial recognition technology. It's looking to China, where we will turn. So, China is the world leader in facial recognition technology, but I would just like to tell China not to get too relaxed about that because the liberal democracies are fast on their heels, unfortunately. India, liberal democracy. The Aadhaar system that they use, again, for very good reasons, give people a digital ID, many of them do not have one, allows them to have their face scanned, their iris scanned, their fingerprint scanned, and access government benefits and services, removing problems of fraud, right? We see it. All of that sounds great. Maybe all of it is great. But we are also starting to get an idea that this can also create another problem. We've covered the United States, I will not dwell. And I have saved special time for the United Kingdom, which is also a leader in this. First, though, there's been a lot of words in this talk, so I thought I would just show us some pictures and ask you if you would like your streets here in Portugal to look like this. This is in China. This is a picture from the New York Times, which is doing amazing coverage at the moment of what is happening in China. These are police officers in China using facial recognition technology in their glasses, or maybe they aren't. There's a lot of speculation that the tech in China isn't actually very good, but it doesn't matter because if people think it is, they'll police themselves. Amazing. And you'll never know. Maybe it was working, maybe it wasn't. You better be safe, right? Skynet. So this is a really great example. Checking the cars for license plates, that's being done all over the United States as well, right? You can check a lot from somebody's car, see who's in the vehicle, then check it with their face, and then you see here on the right, checking through, identify the person, boom. All of the big data that we have on you in government accessed through your face. Do you want that here in Portugal? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. I just hope that you'll have a conversation about it with your lawmakers and possibly your representatives in the European Parliament. We have elections coming up on May 23. I'd love to know what they have to say on this stuff. Here in China are people being publicly shamed as jaywalkers as they walk down the street. I jaywalk all the time in London. It's not a good habit, I know, but I have yet to have my face scanned and have it beamed onto a billboard saying, Stephanie Hare, stop jaywalking. Your mother told you not to do that. Big brother told you not to do that. But it's happening in China. And for other offenses, like if you are behind on your bills, maybe you haven't paid some debts, up on the naughty board with you for everyone to see. Shame is powerful. And here is some workplace surveillance happening at work. Cameras everywhere in a Chinese office. Facial recognition technology tracking you throughout. Are you taking pencils from the stationery cupboard? Are you printing something that you shouldn't be? Why are you printing all of those things? We saw you, we have your face, right? You seem to be spending a lot of time in the toilet. Are you pregnant? What's going on there, right? They know, they can track it. And they even track people in the toilets. You use facial recognition technology to get toilet paper. Now you will go, what on earth? What problem were they solving with this? The problem was, people in China were stealing toilet paper rolls, the whole thing. They would steal it. I can see from the city's point of view, that's, you know, that adds up, right? There's a lot of people living in China. If everybody's stealing toilet paper rolls, that's costing the city a lot of money. How to solve this problem? Build a facial recognition technology system where after, you know, you want to use the loo, you go up, you scan your face, you're given your allotted amount of loo roll, into the toilet you go. If you're not in the database, I guess you just don't get toilet paper roll. But there's a dark side to all of this. I'm going to pull out just briefly the fact that I trained as an historian, and I trained as an historian of a civil servant in France who was later convicted of crimes against humanity for his role in the Holocaust. His name was Maurice Papon, and I interviewed him for 3 years before he died for my doctorate. So I'm very aware, despite being American, I'm very European in my training and sensitivity about the Second World War in this continent, about the number of concentration camps and death camps in Europe. And that was a big part of my training as an historian. And I tracked this civil servant because he became France's top civil servant. He became a member of parliament. He became a government minister before he finally got caught. And then it took him 16 years to be brought to trial. And I was there when he was on trial. I was 21 years old. And it was one of the most important experiences of my life as a person, and launched my training as a professional and as an academic researcher. Because I wanted to know how on earth someone who had gone to the best universities and actually had come from a quite liberal family, who seemed like a good person, who was rated by everyone he worked with at work as being a wonderful civil servant, how on earth did he think it was okay to round people up, put them in a camp, and deport them from France to the East? 76,000 people were deported from France. Only 3% of those people returned, and that's just France, right? There were 140,000 deported from the Netherlands. And I won't go into all of them. As a result, I am very, very sensitive intellectually to countries rounding up citizens, interning them, deporting them, and killing them, because I've studied it deeply. And I listened to every excuse in the book as to why they thought it was okay. And luckily, we decided as a society that it wasn't okay, and we put these people on trial and we locked them up, if there's enough evidence to convict them, because it's a liberal democracy and we have laws. China has an estimated 1 million people locked up in a mass internment camp in the west of the country. These people are known as Uyghurs. Being Uyghur is an ethnic identity. They are also Muslim. China is locking them up because it wants them to be re-educated. So that sounds quite Soviet right there. To abandon their Uyghur ethnic identity and embrace a Chinese Han identity. They also want them to stop being Muslim. They are made to do forced labor so that they can be productive. Facial recognition technology is one of the forms of biometrics that's being used to intern a million people in a camp. And P.S., these are not my words. These are the words of the United Nations. The United Nations said last year, this is a mass internment camp. I personally think that what is happening to the Uyghur Muslims of China has a lot of parallels that are quite worrying with what we saw in the Second World War. Again, like our concept of captive audiences of children and refugees and prisoners and people at work, etc., I'm not sure who's going to stand up for the Uyghurs. Most people don't know who they are, they don't know where it is, they're not familiar with China, they don't know the West. Do they care? Maybe not. I care, because what can happen to the Uyghurs could be done to anyone else. The Chinese are not just using facial recognition technology on them. They take their DNA. That's how you prove that they're Uyghur, you see. You can identify people by their ethnicity through their DNA. They take their fingerprints, and they take their voice. They are doing this in part with the help of certain US technology companies which have helped them build the tech. It's not even 100% Chinese technology. Americans have helped build this and fund it and provide expertise. All of this is being in the open. This is all, you can read about this in the New York Times. In the deck that I have, which you are all welcome to have a copy of, there will be footnotes for every single fact I have given you tonight. Every single one of them comes from a newspaper that you can read for a dollar a day. This is happening in plain sight. And if you think that China will stop with the Uyghurs, or that no other country on earth will take a look at that and go, huh, we've got a population that we could fancy controlling a bit more, you need to read your history again. China has over 40 social credit systems. They are mapping all of the big data about all of the people that they are gathering. Right now, this is still under construction. It's not just one form, there's 40. But the goal, eventually, is to make it one. That will link all of the data that people have on you, like a credit score, right? Which we're used to having. Everybody's got a credit score, fine. That's all gonna be locked up and linked up with all of the other data that they have about you, and the single unifying piece of data to make sure that all of that data is correct to you is your face. It's the easiest way to do it, right? It's easier to take somebody's face than almost any other form of biometric about them. And as I've said, they don't even know you're doing it half the time. They use this already, this is already happening, to fine people, to punish them, and to reward them. I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on this because we've got slides to go through, but again, I've underscored here, you know, in the think category, like, it sounds great. You get penalized for jaywalking or not paying a parking ticket. You probably should be penalized for that. Most people just get penalized by the fine, but okay. You get rewarded for being a parent. Okay, that's interesting. But actually, do you know what? A lot of credit rating agencies would reward you for being a parent, right? Because they think you're a better bet. They think you're more responsible. And I'm like, okay, that sounds great, except that actually that kind of penalizes people who can't be parents, right? Like, maybe they just physically can't have a kid. Should they get penalized? That sounds a bit unfair. They don't get a mortgage because of that? They don't get a job? Or why are you getting rewarded for being a parent? What if you're an awful parent? What if you beat your kid? What if you're just never around? Or you're just mean to them? Why do you get a reward for being a parent, right? Like, it's the choices we make about data are not neutral. They are decisions. They are values. And right now they're happening, and most of us are just sort of walking around living with this, and we're not looking at the choices that were made to build the technology that is affecting our lives. And China is a really interesting case study on it because they're just going for it. I've touched on the Uyghurs, so I'm going to pass this slide so that I can return to my final case study, which is my adopted homeland of the United Kingdom, where I have lived since 1998. So I basically had an American childhood and a British adulthood. I took this picture, ironically, while going to give a radio interview about facial recognition technology being used by the police. And I was following this on Twitter. This is in the center of London. This is right near Leicester Square. If you go to London on vacation, have some fun, you will walk past this theater. It's right in the center. This does not look like a police van. It is not labeled. It's green. What the heck? It has facial recognition technology on the roof, and it is scanning everyone's face that walks by. There were no signs to let anyone know this was happening. Nobody's consent was obtained. Nobody had their rights explained to them. If they're like, do you know what? Actually, I don't want to be part of this. Like, sorry, not my bag. The London Metropolitan Police has tested this technology 10 times. Another police force in the UK, South Wales, has tested it 29 times. That's just in the past 2 years. 29 plus 10 is 39. 39 trials of facial recognition technology, and it's a technology that is not even addressed in UK law. It's a grey area. And grey area means if it's not forbidden, go for it. For people who say nothing to hide, nothing to fear, I'm like, actually, nothing to hide except this. You've got 10 million UK citizens' faces in your criminal database. The people who built the database built it in such a way so that innocent people's data is kept with the criminals, by the way, which is really troubling. The tax authorities, which is HMRC, were found to have been recording, again, without full legality, the voices of 7 million taxpayers. Now, that doesn't sound bad if you're like, this is great. Tax fraud is a real issue, right? There's so many good uses for this. Tax fraud is a real issue. I don't want you to be able to call up the tax authority pretending to be me, access my account, get my money, or commit some sort of fraud, right? So if they have my voice sample, they could be like, nope, this is Stephanie. You don't sound like Stephanie. Great. But now that we know what we know about voice data and what you can know from a 30-second voice sample, I can know your gender. I can know your age to within 3 years. I can get 60 to 70% of what your face looks like. I can also know things like your socioeconomic status. I can know your class. I can know what kind of education you've had. In Britain, that's still a really big deal. I can know what part of the country you're from geographically. I can have a pretty good guess if English is your first language, if you grew up with a parent who spoke another language, or if you are living with someone who has another language. The voice can actually reveal much more data about you than even your face, right? I can look at you and maybe guess, does she have a French mom or not? You open your mouth and speak 30 seconds. We can analyze it. We can find it. I can guess your state of health. The voice can be measured to such a fine level of granularity that we can know certain illnesses before you and your doctor do. What would someone do with 7 million voice samples? Imagine if you're a health company, a health insurance company, and you want to deny people health care coverage. Happens all the time in the United States. They love it. They love to find ways to not pay out. How many people have to call a call center in the United States, right? We all have to call call centers. Often they tell you that your voice is being recorded for training purposes. Training for what? In the United Kingdom, we are seeing both of the police forces that have tested this technology having legal action brought against them by two human rights and civil liberties organizations. The Information Commissioner's Office, which is our data protection agency, is also investigating them. This means that UK taxpayers are having to pay for the technology to be used on us. We're paying for the police to have to mount a legal defense, and we're paying for the regulator to investigate it. Facial recognition technology has been debated once in the House of Lords, which is an unelected body. It has not been debated in the House of Commons, whose representatives we elect. All of that has happened outside of proper democratic control in a liberal democracy. I interviewed the UK Biometrics Commissioner for the BBC in August. It's on my website, you can listen to it. It's a 6-minute interview with him, with Norman Lamb, who heads the Science and Technology Committee in the House of Commons, with Detective Superintendent Bernie Golopin, who leads facial recognition technology for the Metropolitan Police, with Silky Carlo, who's the director of Big Brother Watch, which is one of the civil liberties groups that's bringing legal action against the Met. Professor Paul Wiles, who's the UK Biometrics Commissioner, said, listen, I'm really worried because we've got this whole generation of biometrics that is not covered in law. It's being used by the private sector. They're just going for it. And it's being used by other branches of government. Only DNA and fingerprints are protected, and only by the police. Everything else needs to be covered. right? The UK has its revised biometric strategy coming up in June 2018. They released a rather unimpressive first draft in June of 2018, so they took another 12 months. It's kind of like with Brexit, they gave themselves an extension. So I have diarized for June 2019. I will be really looking forward to seeing what progress they have made, because they hadn't covered any of this in their 17-page first draft. Scotland has its own separate laws and governance for biometrics. They are drafting a biometrics bill right now as well, so I've diarized for that. So we may see change and improvement in the UK. I'm an optimist. I think things can always get better, but we need to keep an eye on it. I'm just going to say this for one moment. It's really tempting to think all we need is law. If we just have laws and regulation, then we're safe. No. The United Kingdom's Home Office, which is like our Minister of the Interior, got caught last year by the Financial Times breaking UK policy. You're not supposed to demand DNA samples to prove that someone is a British citizen. It's in the biometric strategy. Not supposed to be able to do it. Now, if somebody wants to voluntarily give a DNA sample, they of course can. So one way that you can compel someone to give a DNA sample is simply refuse to accept any other form of proof. If you need your citizenship, you're going to hand the DNA over. They got busted by, again, some amazing journalists. And they've apologized, and the Home Secretary ordered a review and said that that should never happen, it should always be voluntary. And everyone was like, oh, outrageous, tisk. I'm just citing it so that you don't think all we need to do is just get a law passed and we're good. No. We need to get laws passed, and then we have to stay very, very vigilant. Because again, this is not China. These are not Uyghurs. This is the United Kingdom's Home Office doing this to British citizens. As for facial recognition technology, they know they're not supposed to be taking facial and voice data. A high court ruling in 2012 actually ordered the Home Office to stop doing it. They said it's illegal, you can't do it. Or it's unlawful, is the right word. But for 5 years, they carried on defying the high court ruling. So that's a really interesting thing. The courts, not enough. It had to be enshrined in law, because it's not. We were relying on a court to say this was allowed or not. But the Home Office defied it. Who's going to fire the Home Office? In the United Kingdom, the Home Office is part of government. They're not going to punish themselves. This is why we need the law in the first place. A high court ruling wasn't enough to get them to stop. They kept taking it. They have had the 39 facial recognition trials that we've had just in the past 2 years alone. That should have been stopped in 2012. So what they did is they created a little fudge. They were like, okay, if you're an innocent person, and by the way, we've changed the wording. In the United Kingdom, you are no longer innocent until proven guilty. The Home Office at the time was a woman named Amber Rudd. She's now still in cabinet, by the way. Really important politician. Amber Rudd said, unconvicted persons can have they can ask to have their facial images taken. I want you to just savor that for a moment. See, the United Kingdom is the country of George Orwell, who was very alive to how the state uses language to subtly shift power. Unconvicted persons means that you are not innocent until proven guilty. You're just someone we haven't convicted yet. Chills. After the Brexit referendum, by the way, she was also the Home Office Secretary who said that she wanted to have a list of all of the foreigners who are employed by companies given to the government. As someone who is foreign-born and given my history background, that scared the shit out of me. And what made me really happy was the British people freaked out and said, absolutely not. And then she was like, oh, sorry, it was just an idea. It's not just an idea. If they hadn't said no, she'd have that list. And I and all of my foreign-born friends would be on that list. And we would just have to hope that they wouldn't abuse it. But I don't particularly trust governments not to abuse power, because I'm an historian. When I interviewed the biometrics commissioner, he said this workaround that you can ask to have your facial image taken that should never have been taken, you can ask to have it removed. He said, it's not a really good workaround because we're not really convinced that most people know they even have that right, right? The numbers applying seem to be quite low, and the Home Office can always say no. So you, innocent person, can apply to have your image removed, but the government can say, no, we're going to keep it because we think you're still maybe going to commit a crime, or just because it's nice to have information. Interviewing Norman Lam, head of the Science and Technology Committee in the House of Parliament, he says this is not a satisfactory position. By the way, that's British for, this is totally unacceptable. As an American, I've never really understood the difference between American English and British English. It's taken me 20 years. This does not appear to me to be a very satisfactory position, is British for, this is not acceptable. In the strongest of terms, with blinking. DNA and fingerprints get deleted automatically if you have not charged someone. That's the law. But face and voice can be kept. And he says that is not okay. I return to my final point, which is about kids. Scotland led the way, weirdly, by taking children's fingerprints from 1999, but since the mid-2000s, children across the UK have had facial image taken. That's fine, that's just a photo. I think most of us wouldn't freak out about that. Like, you wanna know that that kid belongs in the school, you have a register. Fingerprints, seems a bit weird. I don't know any other EU member state that regularly takes children's fingerprints in school. Infrared palm scans for children as young as 4. Why? Because you want to make sure that they're on the premises in the nursery and you're checking them in and out so that no one can kidnap the kid. Okay, seems a bit heavy-handed to me. There might be other ways. Other countries seem to be able to manage nurseries without biometrically scanning all of the children, but maybe the UK has a cultural fear of this for something that we want to look into. Why do you take children's fingerprints? What problem are you solving? Right? Engineers build stuff because they like to solve problems. The problems they are solving are this. Taking attendance, right? You know, when your teacher would be like, you, Amy, Kate, Jenny, Bob, Mike, right? And you're like, yes. Apparently that just takes too much time. So just have them come in, put their finger in, boom, they're logged in for the day. Boom, log them out at the end of the day. It's kind of like when you go to work, almost like you're trying to train a generation of children to get used to that. To pay for school meals. That way you don't have to have money. That can be good if a child comes from a sort of disadvantaged background and maybe has to have school support for food and you don't want them to get noticed and discriminated against or bullied. If you just have every child pay with their fingerprint, great. Send a bill home to mom and dad. Okay? To borrow library books. I don't know a single library on earth that feels the need to scan your fingerprint to borrow a book, and I've studied at the Bodleian in Oxford, okay, where they have priceless books, and they do not ask for my fingerprints. The Library of Congress in the United States does not ask for your fingerprints. The British Library does not require your fingerprints. Why are we asking children to use their bodies to transact, to pay for things, to borrow things, to say, I'm here, I exist? I would personally like to know who in government approved this. Like, who said yes? Somebody had to sign off on that. That didn't just happen. Companies just don't go into schools and start taking kids' data. Someone said, you know what, that sounds wonderful. I am going to give you a budget. The budget is, let's just call it, £10 million. That's in the accounts. Someone can find this out. People have actually tried to find it out, and they've made it really hard. You can't just like write a letter to the Ministry of the Education and say, hi, I'd like to know what's been happening for the past 20 years in every British school. You have to file a Freedom of Information request to every single school in England and Wales. Scotland is different because Scotland has its own government since 1997, ditto Northern Ireland. I interviewed a woman named Pippa King, who is a parent, and an activist on this issue. She's done tons of research, and the research that they have found, they think, and this figure blows my mind, in 2007 to 2008, out of a population of about 9 million school children, we found that about 2.7 million had gone through a fingerprint scanner or some sort of biometric device. Now, we think that the probability of a child touching a fingerprint scanner by the time he or she has finished school at the age of 18 or 19 is probably about 75 to 80%. So, most of them. I did a fun little thing, because I'm that kind of person, with my friends. I was like, is your kid having their data scanned at school? And they were like, don't be ridiculous. So I was like, could you just double check? The amount of my friends who came back to me and said, I'll be damned, you're right. The parents had no idea. And I live in England, so that's a problem, because since 2012, parents are required by law to give their consent, as is the child. So why did my friends not know? Weird. I'm sure it's just an accident. I would like to just point out that the Protection of Freedoms Act of 2012 only protects children in England and Wales. Scottish children do not enjoy these protections, nor do children in Northern Ireland. In other words, children in half of the United Kingdom are protected and can give consent, and their parents can give consent. Actually, they have to give consent, and the rule is if either the child or the parent says no, the no trumps the yes. So you can't have it where the kid says no, but the parent says yes. Like, no, the kid and the parent both have to agree to this. Otherwise, no fingerprinting. That's the law. But just for English and Welsh children. Scottish children, not protected yet. And the biometrics bill, the draft of that, that I saw back in the autumn of last year, did not address this gap. So I went to Scotland last month and spoke about it at DataFest in Edinburgh, where the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, was there. And I raised these points, and I showed these slides, and Scottish people took photos, and we put them on Twitter. So I would really like to see Scotland protect its children and give them equal rights to children in England and Wales. Northern Ireland is trickier because Northern Ireland has not had a government for 2 years. It's basically being governed like a province from Westminster, which we don't like to talk about because that's a very sensitive subject right now. Northern Ireland is supplying, through 10 members of parliament, the supply and confidence in the current government. If they were to withdraw it, that government would collapse. They're needed to get Brexit through. So we're not going to be rocking any boats in Northern Ireland until Brexit's done. Which means Northern Irish kids could have their data taken, legally, and parents and children would have no rights. This is a liberal democracy, and it's all happening out in the open. It's not like I've found some sort of amazing secret that I've come to Lisbon to tell you. I've found all of this in the public domain. I've gone and interviewed people. Last slide, last steps. What do we do? I hope that I have given you plenty of things to think about tonight, both the good things that biometrics could potentially do, but also the risks and how we're going to need to think about them to craft laws and regulations to protect ourselves and our kids. This concept of future-proofing means we need to think about those laws being not just good for the biometrics that we have today, but the ones that we figure out. Ears, skin. Things that right now technology is not able to be useful for could be viable in 10 years' time. The laws need to reflect that. It could just be anything on the body, right? Automatic deletion from police databases of any biometrics data that is taken from people who are acquitted of an offense or where proceedings are not pursued against them. So basically, whatever the police are doing with DNA and fingerprints, do it with everything else. Let's not have this rubbish about different laws for different types of body data. They know it's wrong. Let's just fix it. And finally, the commercial sector, which has gotten, I think, a fairly light pass tonight. Mentioning, of course, the stars, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and IBM one more time. They're not being regulated. They actually want to be regulated. That's weird. Let's give them what they want. Let's regulate them. And let's make sure that when we do it, we protect the most vulnerable people in our society, those captive audiences, and particularly our kids, who are going to grow up in this world. And when they become adults, we'll look at all of us and ask what on earth we were thinking. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. That was fascinating, terrifying, and completely overwhelming, but this is amazing. I wonder, this is a bit of a generic question, so how do you balance doing your work in terms of exposing all of these things and, you know, summarizing it in a way that we can use it, and hitting these massive power structures that essentially are there to stop us from doing anything. So how do you balance that and continue doing your work?
Well, I mean, I can't say I'm doing a very good job in that we don't have the laws and regulations that I really think are part of the solution, but I only started a year ago, and I'm pretty stubborn, so I might outlast them. As a scholar, as a researcher, and as someone who has worked in technology and for some companies who have a very interesting track record that could be discussed, I have, I think, a responsibility to use the training. When I was in the United Kingdom, I was very lucky and I won a lot of scholarships that were funded by the UK government. So the UK invested in me. The United States invested in me as a child in terms of the education that I had. And I feel it's my responsibility as a researcher to use the skills that I was trained with and the education I was given to help society. Because I've worked in technology, I have had the opportunity to hear things and see things and do things well ahead of a lot of people. And the stuff I'm seeing now terrifies me. So I actually don't feel I have a choice. I have to do this work. There are kids in my life that I want to be able to look at in the eye and say, I did everything I could to protect you. There were grown-ups who, when I was a child, passed things like the Clean Air Act so that the air is clean and the water is clean, and I got to benefit from that as a kid because grown-ups fought for us, right? I want to try and do that. I'm trying to use research and public engagements, like flying here and having wonderful invitations like I've had tonight to come and speak with all of you to send you away. Maybe you had heard about this a little bit. I hope I've sent you away with something new. I'm giving away my research so that if people want to use it and share it and make it go viral, I would love that. Send it around. I would love for people to be emailing and calling their representatives in Parliament and in the European Parliament. The EU is really leading the way on data protection. This continent, the European Union, has a better chance than I think almost anyone of forcing through this kind of protection. And if Britain could stop thinking about Brexit for 5 seconds and take a look at what's happening in Brussels and the protections and civil rights and human rights we've gotten from that, they could work with it. But right now, the UK is just going through a really difficult patch. So it's great to be in another EU member state that's perhaps having a calmer moment and can think about technology, because our brains are just very full right now in the UK. The United States is considering it, but we've got 50 states. I come from the state of Illinois, which has some of the strongest biometrics protections out of all 50. But these technology companies have money, and they are going to lobby to water down and weaken any privacy bill that's passed in the United States. They've already been doing that. They make money out of surveillance. I am encouraged by some of the statements and actions I have seen by companies like Apple and Microsoft, and frankly, Google, from with, you know, restraining itself. I'm sure it could unleash all sorts of facial recognition technology on us if they wanted to. IBM, I think, deserves what it's got tonight. That's all in the public domain. Why are they doing that? Their shareholders and their board need to answer for that. So I'm trying to use my voice as a citizen, as a researcher, as a technologist. You know, I want to work in tech and feel proud of what I do. I don't want to feel ashamed. And I think a lot of people who work in tech feel that way.
I'll just move here, okay. No, actually I don't need to move, so I'll go back to my seat. So, hi.
Hi.
Really loved your talk. So two questions for you to solve them, of course. The first one is, I feel a little bit concerned if the tech companies, they want to, as you said, level the field in terms of regulation. So for me, if they're taking the first step, it sounds to me that they want to basically create the landscape in which they will act upon. So for me, that's slightly scary. So I would like to hear your thoughts about that. And the second thing had to do with something that you mentioned before, like if you're some insurance companies or some banks, they will improve your credit rate if you're a parent. But, and I don't want to be the person that says, but this is only a tool, because I don't think it's only a tool, but doesn't this sort of behavior already happens when, for example, in the Portuguese tax authority, they actually give you a benefit if you are married, if you have children. So basically, it's enforcing an already existent stereotype. So yeah. How about that, Stephanie?
Those are both great questions. I'm going to take them in reverse order because my brain is tired. Absolutely, technology reinforces existing power structures, right? Without reflection. And you know, you can view that as, okay, I'm going to build this tool. That's an opportunity for me to engage with an existing power structure and possibly to try to change it. How do I create more equality, right? How do I create greater opportunity? Or, absolutely, as you say, how do I just, you know, take what we're doing in the analog world and make it digital, right? And you're absolutely right. And I think this is the problem that the tech community is finally coming to terms with, is going, we have got to have people who are building tech who are plugged in to debates that are happening elsewhere in universities, by researchers, and just in general society, right? Like, there are lots of people who've been thinking about this stuff outside of computer engineering and computer science. They're in the humanities department. They're in the philosophy department. They're in social science. They're historians. They are, you know, the STS community, so science and technology studies, you know, and a lot of that scholarship exists already. We don't even have to reinvent the wheel, it's there, but it hasn't been integrated. But that also could just be a conversation within, you know, sort of very niche, small world of researchers and academics and the like. The question is, how do we take this out and make it truly democratic? And that is where I think evenings like tonight, right, a bunch of us, we all could have been sitting on the couch watching Netflix. Right? We could have all just been chilling out. I might have gone swimming. Instead, we made a choice with our free time to come here and have this chat. I chose to make this presentation. You chose to come and listen to it. Hopefully, we will all get something out of it and feel engaged and go and spread the word and think about it and maybe just consume tech differently. Maybe we'll get really pissed off and start, you know, lobbying our MPs. Who knows? So I think there's a massive piece of work to do, and I think we're just getting started. It's like an awakening. So you don't need biometrics to perpetuate or to create these inequalities. You're absolutely right. They already exist. They can make it worse, though. So we need to think about that. And then the first one, in terms of creating the playing field, this is really tricky. So tech companies have first mover advantage, right? Like, you can't stop people from inventing stuff. They've invented it. The genie is out of the bottle. They are sensible enough, at least in the US, and not all of them, but I think a decent amount that I've shown tonight, a few of the companies are quite aware that while they might make a lot of money building the panopticon right away, that could potentially have blowback. That could lead to some really bad outcomes, and they seem to be mindful enough to be asking the government to step in. Which of course makes us, you know, if we could take on the spotlights that's on my face right now, I want to take it and sort of shine it over at the US Congress and go, all right, ladies and gentlemen, we pay you a lot of money. What's your position on facial recognition technology? I haven't heard a single US congressman in either house come out about this. I don't know what anyone in the Senate thinks, except for Senator Ron Wyden. He's leading on that. I have no idea what any of the people in Congress and the House of Representatives think. I don't know what President Trump thinks. I don't know what the Supreme Court thinks. Nobody's brought a lawsuit yet, right? So, like, unfortunately, the debate has been started by the creators, and that makes all of us have to react. So in the United Kingdom, it's Big Brother Watch and Liberty, these civil organizations that are bringing legal action against the police. I actually feel for the police, because the police are actually just trying to do their best, particularly in London, where we've had terrorism and knife crime. It's, you know, it's very bad there, and the government has, of course, cut the budget since 2008 with the financial crisis. So they're having to do more with less. And then the government comes along and goes, you can trial this technology. And if it works, great. Value for money. We love that in the UK, right? It's really good investment of taxpayers' dollars. So the police are like, okay, the government has said we can do it. There's nothing saying we can't. There's no law. We're going to try it. And if it works, it helps to keep people safe. Great. I can see that argument. I can see where they've made that call. I'm also very grateful to Big Brother Watch and Liberty for bringing legal action against this. I think we all are, because we know that this hasn't been addressed by Parliament. The people who have not done their jobs yet are in the House of Commons. There's 650 of them getting paid a lot of money every year to not deal with this. It's weird. So they need to, and that's going to be in every Parliament, because this technology will come here. If you haven't seen it yet, it will come here. Right? Right? Okay, I didn't want to speak, so I haven't studied Portugal in depth, but... Right. And it could be in your shopping mall, identifying you, matching your shopping preferences, things that maybe you don't want them knowing. There could be all sorts of risks of discrimination with that. Right? So, like, we need government to step up. But then you can see from the point of view of government, they're like, ooh, we don't like to regulate unless we absolutely have to. We need to have some studies, right? So then it comes back to the researchers who are like, here's your study. We're going to throw a bunch of studies at you. So this is going to be a really messy, iterative process. We will not solve it right away. But what I would love for us to do is, before we roll the stuff out, maybe we could dial it back, study it first, talk about it. Unfortunately, we have a living laboratory in China where we're going to watch them rolling out. And the Philippines. There's plenty of authoritarian regimes who are going to roll it out, and we can watch and see some of the worst case scenarios, not all. I think we could invent quite a lot of worst case scenarios on our own. But we could at least not do it to our own people. That would be a start. We have a choice. We don't have to build this world. Right? We don't have to put facial recognition everywhere. We don't have to be taking people's voices. We don't have to be taking people's DNA and then selling it on and using it without their consent. We have choices. So, yes, the companies have started. It's now up to us. Are we going to sit back? And sitting back's the easy answer, right? We could just let them dictate it. That's our choice.
Well, thank you for the talk.
Thank you.
I just have a small question about, well, It seemed like the only hopeful case you mentioned at some point was the iPhone that collected information locally and didn't share it with the mother company. And many times during your talk, you kind of mixed data collection and the uses of data. How do you think that separation works in practice? I mean, a company can sometimes collect data, anonymized, but not really cross it with other companies' data or others or sets of personal data. For instance, if you use facial recognition in the supermarket, it might be recognizing people, but not you specifically.
Right.
So how do you address
this? Facial analysis versus facial recognition.
Yeah, I mean, recognizing children, for instance, or other, using it for specific things and not necessarily crossing you with your personal preferences.
You raise an important distinction. So facial analysis, they don't necessarily need to know that it's Stephanie Hare's face. They're just like, a woman has entered the store. She's going for the chocolate. She's scanning the different brands. Ooh, she seems to like the brands that have red labels. Note, change labels to red if we want to sell to women age 42 from America, right? Like, you're absolutely right. They don't need to know, this is Stephanie Hare. She's got a 42-year history of buying chocolate. This is a known offender. She buys it every week. She only buys M&Ms, plain, not peanut. When she buys M&Ms, she also buys it with these 10 items. Right, like, you know, she only buys them at night. We think that she's buying it at night because she writes at night, and M&Ms is a stress food. She stress eats M&Ms, right? Like, that's the difference, right? The difference is like all of that data about me specifically versus women who come into the store or just people who come into the store who go to the chocolate section have these behaviors. And you're right, you can anonymize that if you like. Although one thing I would say is this, anonymization is not great. It's pretty easy to work back so-called anonymized data sets and even pseudonymized data sets to people. So again, just we would have to explore privacy protections at scale. Do they work? Are they tested? And again, I would just say this. Do you think most of the people in your parliament have the technological knowledge to be able to even craft the laws that would regulate something like that? I just watched in the United States where Congress interrogated Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, and we had senators literally saying, but what do you do? And Mark Zuckerberg had to say, Senator, we sell ads. You know, it was painful. It was painful to watch. The UK Parliament was much more switched on, and so was the European Parliament, but the Congress, it was just a pony show. So just in terms of the distinctions you raise, I absolutely agree with. That's like advanced thinking for Parliament at the moment. We have such a job on our hands to even build the concepts that we're discussing here so that they are absolutely mainstream, so that people can make exactly those distinctions and go, well, maybe we're fine with that. I don't mind when I'm shopping if people are taking that kind of behavioral data. I personally would, by the way, but maybe other people would be fine with it. But then what do you do? So say you're fine with it, but I'm not. I guess I cannot shop in that store. But what if I live in a town where there's only one grocery store? Right? Like, where's choice?
But why not?
Sorry?
Why not? You said, I personally don't, but why?
I just personally don't want people taking my data. I just don't like it. It makes me uncomfortable. I'm Generation X, maybe, right? And again, I'm sure it's also because I'm an historian. I think when people have data, you can do stuff with it. I can tell you, I can do stuff with data right now that would make your hair curl. Seriously, and I'm not even good. Like, there are people who can do amazing stuff with data. So like, I just don't want people to have it. The less data you have, the more stuff you can do with it. I think you need to be very responsible with data. As I was coming here tonight, I just saw that the United Kingdom has just had a data breach involving the emails of journalists, something like 300 of them. They can't keep data safe. So I err on the side of extreme caution, which is an extreme position of, if you can't keep data safe, and God knows with the amount of data breaches we've had from both governments and the private sector in the past 10 years, you can't even keep track of it anymore, just don't collect my data. 100% guaranteed way for you to not lose it.
Can you expand on, you just said there that I'm a historian, I know what they can do with data. Mm. I mean, what
yeah,
happened in
absolutely.
France,
in fact, do you mind if I get out a prop out of my bag? Sorry. I'm so excited to finally get to talk about French medieval history in a tech lecture. You have no idea. You just made my day. I feel like you and I almost worked that out beforehand. Well done. So, the reason I have this book on hand is because I'm writing a book at the moment, and I want to cite this, and I'm citing it in, I've just finished the biometrics chapter, so that's why I've got all this stuff still in my head. I'm moving on this week to chapter 2. My publishers will be delighted to hear it's chapter 2. They'll be like, why weren't you almost done? It's just chapter 2 right now. On big data. And the reason I have this book, which is called Montaillou, it's by a French historian named Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie, and it is a world-famous portrait of life in a medieval village. I love this stuff, right? It just sounds so random and weird. And when you read it, it's like it allows you to be a voyeur, right? And that's the thing about human beings, is human beings are voyeurs, and historians are some of the worst. So of course, when Professor Leroy Ladurie got a hold of this incredible document that he had, it's basically a record. It's like if Facebook existed in the Middle Ages just for a village in the Pyrenees, this is it. So you can find out, I mean, these people are dead now, right? They're dead 6 centuries. I know what they had for lunch because of this and his analysis of it, his research, which is just impeccable, and it's so entertaining. I know who was having affairs. I know what the priests were doing and what money they did with it. I know what the average size of farms were, who had what sheep, who was good with their money, who you should not loan to. Social credit scores, China, you did not invent that. That stuff was happening in the Middle Ages in the Pyrenees, right? And in Britain, we have the Doomsday Book, right? So when William the Conqueror came over from Normandy and took over, he was like in a typical megalomaniac fashion. He was like, I think he must have been a historian in training. He was like, we need data. I've got a new territory, map it out. So the Doomsday Book is just a big data set. So you can go, I lived in a little village when I first moved to the UK that is one of the first towns mentioned and recorded in the Doomsday Book, and it's got everybody, you and you and you and you, and how you're related and how you fit in a network, because your data is never just about you. That's another reason I don't like people collecting my data. It's not just about me. If they know about me, they can know about my family and friends. If I'm a psychiatrist, they could know about my patients. If I'm a lawyer, they could know about my clients. If I'm an abortion provider, they could know about the women who come to me for abortions, right? So like, you can see why perhaps I get nervous about this. If I'm a journalist, they could track my sources. Even when the government isn't leaking my email address, they could be tracking my sources. And some sources need to be anonymous. Some of them are whistleblowers. Some of them get killed for being compromised. In countries like Russia, right? So it's a really big deal to protect people's data. I take that really seriously. And what I love about things like this is that this is being done analog style. I mean, this is being done in those, you know, big notebooks, right? That monks would have been writing everything down, pictures. It's all data. And with the right computing power and some creative brains who've been trained to work with it, think it, and are unleashed to solve problems with this kind of data, you could just pore through this and ask yourself all sorts of really interesting questions that people back then might not have even asked themselves about themselves. And you can tell people things from data that they don't even realize. That's called inferences.
Can you give an example where it was used in the past?
Give an example of where data has been used abusively in the past.
A concrete example. I'm just saying it could be used like that.
Oh, where it could be used.
But it wasn't.
I'm choosing between the many that are screaming in my brain for attention. Let's pick. Using big data now. With computer processing power now, or just any type of data that can be abused.
Use of data.
Yeah,
use of data. Collected by a country, a nation.
Yeah.
And then used abusively. Like, I'm just a concrete mm-hmm. example.
Mm-hmm. No.
Because, I mean, that to me sounds a bit speculative, to be honest. It's like, sorry? I mean,
The Rwandan genocide?
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Okay, thank you. That's a good prompt. Sorry, I was tired, so I needed a break. You've just reminded me, and this is why I'm going to tell you this. So, fun fact, another French history example, if you'll indulge me. In France, they do not keep a record of how many Jewish people they have, or Muslim population, or anyone's religious identity, right? It's a secular state. But that's also a very deliberate decision resulting from what happened in the Second World War, because they had kept everybody's data, right? Fun fact, when they were starting to keep everybody's data, part of the reason that they had the list of everyone who was Jewish in Paris, the Paris police had one of the most advanced data systems in the world. It wasn't computerized, of course, it was all analog, but the point is the data itself, the set, existed. Not because they were interested in tracking who was Jewish in Paris in the 1920s and 30s. They were interested in keeping track of their Muslim population because at the time, France had an empire. Algeria was considered part of France as much as Provence is. Morocco and Tunisia were protectorates, as were Syria and Lebanon. But most of the traffic that was coming in and out of France in terms of Muslim immigration was from the three North African countries, right? That was the population they wanted to monitor. But the column, right, in the data set was just going to be religion, croyance. In 1940, when France fell to the Nazis, they were not interested in who was Muslim. They were interested in who was Jewish. The French police knew where all of the adults lived, where all of the children went to school, and which businesses were Jewish owned, because the data had been captured by the state. Nobody would have thought when they started to create that database, and it was effectively a database, that it could be used for that purpose. Nobody thought they would be invaded by Germany again. Nobody knew about the Nazis in the 1920s because the Nazis were just getting started, right? Like, it wasn't what it became and what we think of as now. So they weren't building the database, if you will, with that risk in mind. So as a result, they were able to do that. And they carried on with this sort of ethnographic monitoring of people in Algeria, where the man that I interviewed ended up, after the Second World War, going and making his career that made him the top French civil servant. He did that in the colonies. And they kept quite a lot of data on whether you were Berber, ethnic Berber, versus Jewish, versus Muslim, versus Pied Noir, which is European French, and you could be from Italy, Spain, it didn't have to just be French, right, but you were sort of white Europeans. They had all these different classifications by ethnicity and race. But France today cannot actually tell you, they have estimates, they think it's about 10% of the population is of Muslim origin, but not necessarily practicing, they claim not to know. They're like, we don't record that. And they think they've got one of the largest populations of Jews in Europe, around, I think it's 200,000. I could be wrong on that number, so please don't quote me, but it's definitely around that. But they can't say for certain. But what I can tell you is that using big data analysis, you could probably get pretty close to the accurate answer for both of those questions. Because you don't need someone to tell you things about them. You can work it out indirectly through proxies. So to give a different example, in the United States, we might not want to code somebody by race. We might not want to code queries by race because that would be racist. So you might just take postcodes instead. But postcodes in the United States are socioeconomically charged, right? Different postcodes tend to be dominated by people in different socioeconomic backgrounds. And that tends to fall, not exclusively, but pretty usefully, along racial lines. So you can be like, hey, whoa, we're not searching on race. But you kind of are, or you could. You might be doing it by accident. That's the terrifying thing, is you might not even be setting out to do this stuff, but you can work it out.
There's a professor named Kathy O'Neill who wrote a book called Weapons of Math Destruction, which explains this far better than I ever can. She's a quant from Wall Street who has since gone and worked and done her own thing. PhD in mathematics from Harvard. Absolutely brilliant. The book is very easy to read. You don't have to be a specialist to read it, with really good practical examples about how this exact type of discussion that we're having now is being used to make financial decisions about people, job decisions, etc. So it goes back to my earlier point of why I don't like data being taken. Data can be used in all sorts of ways that are not intended at the original point of collection. It can be done once it's collected without you ever knowing about it, but it can affect you and it can affect people you're related to or just work with or just affect society. So that's why I have that view.
Is it in the UK being used? I mean, is it being motivated by racial issues that you think?
The UK, I would say, is like any other technically advanced liberal democracy in that it is experimenting with all of this technology as much as it can within the law. Whether or not, you know, what the government is doing with this, that I don't know. I don't want to comment on that with any sort of certainty. I have areas of inquiry that I'm looking into, but I don't know. It's possible, but it would be possible anywhere.
Your talk is so exciting. We all have something to ask and to say. I've been waiting here from the very first minutes.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah. You mentioned very shortly Apple as a good example of decision making in one particular situation. Mm. Well, I do use Apple since the very first generations of devices, and I recently bought the last model, Margrave, and I'm very shocked about something, and so I would like to have your informed guess about Apple's decision-making process on this. Mm-hmm. Basically, there are three things that horrify me. One is the feature that allows that records your fingerprint, so you can replace your introduction of password with a fingerprint. Another is that it doesn't allow you, it doesn't enable user over control, meaning, for example, if the computer crashes at some point, you don't have a button anymore, a physical thing to escape, to restart, this and that. And another thing is that it doesn't allow you as a user to disable Siri, the IE embedded, the preferences are actually shorter and shorter. Okay, so I felt horrified because this is purely speculative. This is exactly what I would like to know your opinion on. What were these decisions based on extensive user studies? Do you think it's the people, or is this, where does this come from? Because it's obviously such a big restrainment of freedom. Yeah. I don't think I will buy Apple ever again after, you know. But is it a tendency? Is it going in that direction? You know, where does this come from? Do people really want to over-control us? How is this?
I will answer first by saying I haven't interviewed anyone at Apple, so your guess is as good as mine. What I would say is obviously companies are studying and soliciting feedback from users at all points of design. So you would expect that at some point in Apple's process, they will have talked to users and had feedback about it, as well as employees, right? Like, it's not just users. It's also like, what does the staff think? And there will be studies, and also not just studies by Apple, there'll just be sort of general studies, like what are people's views on fingerprints or data or having a voice control on your phone or not. So on the one hand, it's kind of like with, this particular link. It can be very tempting to think these companies are so amazing, they make so much money, they've thought it all out, they are evil incarnates, they've thought it all out. But then you look at some of the mistakes they make and you're like, oh my God, did you think about that for even 2 seconds? So like on the one hand, I'm like, they think about everything. I'm totally suspicious, you know, really suspicious. And then on the other hand, I'm like, oh my God, like, did they hire any women? Like, did they ask a single woman to look at this? You know, like, you know, where it's like breathtaking. So it's a crapshoot. I guess what I would say is if you don't like it, tell them. Go in, like, act, because if you don't, you know, if you just simply kind of drop off and don't buy anything from them ever again, which is bias, totally your right, and I support you in doing that if you want to do that, they need to hear why, though, because otherwise they can't hear back and go, we're actually getting, there's a strange user preference demographic shift in Portugal. There's a lot of people in Lisbon in this one neighborhood really complaining at that one store that they don't like that feature. Because they can't know. Like, if you don't like it and you don't tell them, then they can't know. So I guess I would just say is, you know, before you divorce Apple, go and have a conversation with them. Tell them at least.
Do you think
I would just go to the store. Yeah. Absolutely.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that not only to be aware of the misuse that the government can do with your data, but also individual people, because it happened to me, someone who made an identity theft, and it was very hard to explain to the police how that was a crime and how it was damaging me, because someone was giving my phone number to an online site where they did a fake profile. And I had to explain an officer in the, like the digital crime department, that like if a man was on the street randomly giving my phone number to strangers, would you think that that is, dangerous? And he said, yes. Well, that's what's happening, but online. So do you understand now? And he said, okay, you need to leave your phone. And I said, okay. But it was very hard for them to understand that it was a crime and that I was unsafe. So if this happens with the officers or the law enforcement, I think if they don't understand that misuse of data and personal information is a crime, how can the rest of the people understand that?
Exactly. So it's just that. Thank you. That's a great point.
My question goes, I found it very surprising what you found out there. I was not aware about this. If you think that the solution should be a European one, maybe, to solve all this, because in my opinion, our main problem, we all have liberal democracies, and we all want to protect rights, but I don't know if you know that Portugal at this point even hasn't an RGPD law in work. We don't have. We are still waiting for our government to pass compliance to the solution to the European Communities RGPD laws.
Right.
And when I see all these things, I just say, well, okay, the interests are common, are basic. We all don't want this normally that our biometric data is stored somewhere. Yep. So should there be not a European solution, maybe?
Biometrics is covered under the GDPR, I think it's Article 12 or 13. Again, don't quote me on it, but I think it's those two. As special data, and there are special protections for it that then, if you had a complaint, you would take to your own country's data protection officer, so the UK information one. Exactly.
I live in Germany, now I'm here in Portugal, and I'm listening frequently, no, we have different laws.
Yeah.
Our data protection law is completely different. It has nothing to do with what you experienced before in another European country.
That's interesting.
And I find this personally very scary.
Yeah.
Because if we all have first to dig into laws or go to lawyers or to
defend exhausting.
Something which is quite basic, as you well pointed out, liberal democracies say, well, prove it. And then say, screw me for it. It's not the other way around. And that's also the impression, it's also in Germany, by the way, where they, in 2017, just by the way, passed a kind of bill which allows going to computers of journalists if they are suspicious.
Yes.
This was passed by the government Merkel. It passed, there were not many organizations reporting about it, only the Computer Chaos Club, they are quite famous in Germany for acting like this. On this behalf, to protect against terrorism, Germany did this. It's possible now for German policy institution, well, more the superior ones, to go into the computer of any citizen traveling for Germany. And this is a country which was, as far as I got to know it, very, 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 very conscious about this issues, just because they had this machinery in the 30s where everything was controlled and then used against people.
Yep.
And so, well, this was more a remark.
No, that's a great remark. I'm going to have to look into that case study because that's new for me.
It's not really a law. They found a way around in Berlin also to put this, it's a kind of directive. Because a law would never go through.
Right.
Because the German constitution is very, very strong at this point. So they found a way. The argument is terrorism, protection against terrorism, and the usual thing, to put it into, they call it the spy attacking, to put it into work. And people are not even, in my friends, not even thinking about this. They're just saying, well, okay, it's there to protect us, so it's good. And that's what I find a little bit bizarre.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, we want the security services and the police to be able to do their job, and that involves different circumstances than would normally have to happen for all sorts of things, and, you know, speed and time can be of the essence, etc. We just want oversight and to be able to trust and have confidence that that's not being abused, and therefore, you're right, understanding how that works. This is what I think is, I just think we're all, I mean, it's such a pain. You know, it's like being in really good shape. Like, you just can't fake it. You're going to have to eat your vegetables and you're going to have to do your exercise. We're going to have to learn and educate ourselves as a society, and, you know, letting this stuff sort of happen with all of us kind of tuning out is not really an option, I think, as these sorts of issues are. And I think people are, I sense it, I think people are becoming much more aware and curious and making decisions much more consciously now than they were even just a few years ago, you know, when people were using social media much more differently, or they're thinking about their kids and what they're doing with their kids' data. That's a new trend I've seen in recent years. So it's entirely possible that you're right. You're raising issues. I mean, Germany has different hate laws, for instance, in terms of what is allowed to be posted on Facebook in Germany is different than in the UK. So even though they're both EU member states, you're right, there's like specificity on a nation state level, or member state level. So I will look into that. Thank you very much. And thank you, all of you. You've been so patient. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.